If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. What makes Cornwall different from the rest of England? Is it history or geography that sets the area apart? And how have the industries of fishing, mining, and tourism all transformed the face of the region? Cornish-born historian and writer Tim Hannigan is the author of The Granite Kingdom, A Cornish Journey, and he addresses these questions in conversation with David Musgrove. Tim began with a reminder of Cornwall's peculiar geography.
Cornwall is, to put it most simply, the southwesterly peninsula, the southwesternmost peninsula of mainland Britain. So it's the leg that sticks way out at the bottom left of mainland Britain. I like to try and put Cornwall in a slightly different perspective. I like to swing the map around. So we're not looking at it in its conventional positioning, which is always centered on London. I like to try and center the map on Cornwall itself. So if you imagine turning it upside down, so Cornwall is sort of sticking vertically upwards instead of slanting away down at the bottom, then you kind of see where it sits in its wider context, because it's pretty much equidistant between Brittany, sticking out from mainland Europe, from France, which is another peninsula with lots of cultural commonalities with Cornwall. And then on the other side, the southern bits of Ireland, the Cork and Kerry. And then actually just sticking over its shoulder there is Wales. So it's part of that Western Atlantic network of interlinked places. So Ireland, Wales and Brittany. Cornwall's really at the heart of that Atlantic world.
Just on the landward side, though, can you just remind us or tell us, for those who don't know, where the border of Cornwall is with the rest of what is now England? What's the line and what does it border to the east?
So the immediate neighbour of Cornwall is the County of Devon, and there's inevitably some sort of petty rivalry between the two. But the bulk of the border, it's not quite as simple as it might seem, but the bulk of the border is made up of the River Tamar, which rises very close to the north coast, but then runs south. So it runs for about 50 miles. It's only 4 miles from the sea on the north coast, but then it runs all the way down to come out at Plymouth on the south coast. And that forms the bulk of the border. And that has been the border between Cornwall and, initially quite explicitly, England as separate places, as the emergent England, since the 10th century. And that actually is this little known point. That actually makes the Cornish border, the River Tamar, one of the, if not the oldest quasi-national frontiers in the whole of Europe. We're often told, if you sort of Google it, what's the oldest national frontier in Europe? Andorra is often mentioned, but that's a couple of hundred years younger than the River Tamar as a quasi-national frontier. So it's a very old, very long established border that people from Cornwall certainly take very seriously.
Do we know what Cornwall actually means, what the origin of the name of the county is?
Well, we know what the wall bit is, definitely. And it has the exact same etymology as Wales, which is possibly slightly better known than the wall of Cornwall. But it is the English, or I should say Old English, Anglo-Saxon word that was given to these two places that we now know as Cornwall and Wales. And that word was Waelas, which was the Anglo-Saxon word for, it's specifically non-Anglo-Saxons, non-English. It sometimes gets translated as foreigners or strangers, but the best way to think of it is just not us, them, the other. So it was the English word for Wales and for Cornwall, Wailas. Those places had their own names for their for the place. Wales, we know, is Cymru, and Cornwall is Curno. But in English, they became Wales and Cornwall. The corn bit of Cornwall is probably from the local name. The modern Cornish word for Cornwall is Curno. Where that kern or corn bit actually comes from, we're not entirely sure, but it's probably got an etymological link to cornu, which would be a Latin word in origin, meaning horn. And if you think about what Cornwall looks like, I explained earlier, it's that bit that juts out. So it probably is something to do with the form of the place, a horn-like peninsula sticking out. So it's Cornwall. It's the foreigners of the horn-like peninsula. That's what the English name Cornwall actually means. So it's otherness, it's separateness from England, or certainly Anglo-Saxon territory, is really right there, explicit in the name, just as the name Wales is.
Okay, so there's etymology there that probably relates to the 8th, 9th, 10th period and what you just talked about there. But let's go back a little bit earlier before we drop into that. What do we know about the early origins of the settlement of Cornwall? It's a place that's famous for many things, but one of the things, and a thing that I love about it, is all its prehistoric megaliths and standing stones. What do we know about the early settling of the place?
As you say, Cornwall is, like a lot of those Atlantic peninsulas and islands that are interconnected with Cornwall, it's just spectacularly rich in tangible archaeology. It's all on the surface, and it's not roped off. You don't have to pay to get into any of it. It's just there, jumbled up with much more recent stuff. Part of that's just down to the geology of the place. It's a stony area, in significant parts made of granite, so all that stuff's on the surface. So Cornwall was first inhabited by people, as far as we know, about 10,000 years ago. And initially, small numbers of hunter-gatherers just left very, very limited traces. But from the Neolithic period, from about 6,000 years ago, it seems to have been permanently settled. There seems to have been communities who rooted in the landscape, who began to build quite spectacular funerary monuments. The oldest significant structures in Cornwall are what are called in Cornwall coits, but are often known as cromlechs or dolmens elsewhere. You'll find similar things in Wales and Brittany and Ireland. Are traditionally understood as tombs, but we tend to think of them as slightly more complicated than that in these days, possibly as central focuses for communities or ritual centres, as well as places of burial. So they're those great big stone mushrooms that might be 6 or 8 feet tall, usually 4 huge upright stone slabs and then a massive capstone sitting on top of them. And those date from the Neolithic period. And that really marks the beginning of a permanent human presence in the landscape, but also that interaction with the landscape. Throughout the later Neolithic period and into the Bronze Age, you get a massive amount of ritual building again. I mean, huge swathes of Cornwall seem to be this kind of living ritual landscape from the late Neolithic or early Bronze Age, stone circles and standing stones, very often arranged with a kind of reference to a prominent hill. It's Rautor in East Cornwall, which is second highest hill on Bodmin Moor. And then in the west, where I'm from in Penwith, it's 2 hills, Carn Cynegyc and Carn Galva seem to be the reference points. And then, you know, Bronze Age gives way to the Iron Age, by which stage Cornwall was really tied into European trade networks because of the tin and copper. I mean, it's one of the major tin and copper producing regions in Europe. And tin, copper, and also gold and lead and silver from Cornwall was traded widely throughout Europe and down into the Mediterranean and even beyond. So Cornwall was linked from a pretty early stage into those networks.
That's a very good point for me to bring back in that concept that you mentioned earlier of swinging the map around, because I recall a conversation I had with Professor Barry Cunliffe for this podcast a little while ago, where we were talking about kind of the prehistory of Brittany, and he was making the point that Brittany and Cornwall were very much linked by the seaways across the channel and sort of invited us to think about things in a different way. Is that kind of the point you're trying to get at, that Cornwall's centre of gravity doesn't necessarily pivot towards the rest of England and Britain, and equally, you know, could well have gone to Europe because of the usefulness of seaways in prehistory for navigation?
Yeah, and not just prehistory, much more recently than that. We're kind of conditioned to think of the sea as an isolating element, partly that's because we don't use it for transport to the same extent that it was for the longest time, but it was for the longest time the fastest and easiest way to travel long distance was the sea. And it was the only way, really, to ship large quantities of stuff in single units was the sea for a very, very, very long time. And we seem to have somehow forgotten that. I think the other factor is the kind of island nation narrative around Britain, which the origins of that, well, that can be, that's another topic for another conversation. But we do forget that the sea was a linking rather than an isolating element. And I think Cornwall and Brittany are a great illustration of that, because the Cornish language and the Breton language are very, very close. They're effectively dialects of the same language. And right until the end of Cornish as a widespread community language in the 18th century, Cornish and Breton were mutually comprehensible. A Cornish speaker from Cornwall could step ashore on a harbour side in Brittany without speaking French and without knowingly speaking Breton. They could buy their groceries, they could sell their fish in their own native language and be understood by Bretons. And Bretons came to Cornwall. There was a lot of Breton settlement in Cornwall. Breton fishermen came over for shorter stays. And the language, they spoke effectively the same language. So somebody from the far west of Cornwall, somebody from somewhere around Penzance in, let's say, the 17th century, would have found it easier to communicate with somebody from Roscoff or Brest than to communicate with somebody from Exeter or Bristol or London. They may very well have spoken English, but English would have been their second language. They may not have spoken English particularly well, but they could use their own first language, Cornish, to talk to Bretons and be understood. So that really hammers home that point that you can be on the same island, the same large island, but not have the close cultural commonality as people on a neighbouring landmass that you're connected to by the sea. And I think, yeah, Cornwall and Brittany are a perfect example of that.
Sure. So where would you place the origins of the Cornish separateness from the rest of England? Where does it come in? Is it way back into prehistory, or is it, as you were talking about a little bit earlier, more to do with Anglo-Saxon settlement from the post-Roman period onwards?
Yeah, so it's a hugely complicated question, and I think there are just multiple layers to it. I think it's fairly obvious that Cornwall's earliest major connections would have been by sea. So right from the earliest stage of Cornwall's settlement, it would have been quite closely linked to Brittany, to Southern Ireland, probably to South Wales as well, because those were the easiest places to get to. It was quick. You got on a boat and you could be there in a day or in a couple of days. If you wanted to travel to Eastern England, somewhere around where London is today, that in itself was probably best done by sea. But if you went overland, it was a tough and difficult journey. So I think from the very earliest stages, Cornwall's closest, most obvious connections were to those places. And I think you still get little glimpses of that today. My home place in the far, far west is on the north coast of the Penwith Peninsula, north of Penzance. And when there's high pressure, when the weather is clear, we cannot listen to BBC radio because we get the Irish radio. It just comes floating in across the Celtic Sea and knocks off the broadcasts from London because Ireland is closer. There's nothing in the way. So, you know, that connection was always there. What began to crystallize Cornwall as a distinct place, the distinct place apart that it kind of still is today, I think definitely was the Anglo-Saxon settlement. Cornwall comes into being as Cornwall in concurrence, in tandem with the emergence of England. We were talking about the name earlier. The name of Cornwall explicitly has that word Waelas, same as Wales, which means effectively un-English. So Cornwall becomes Cornwall because England exists. And that really is the origins of Cornwall as it is today. Cornwall, although a lot of Cornish people, certainly all Cornish nationalists would say Cornwall is definitely not England, Cornwall exists as Cornwall because of England. And you could say the same thing about Wales as well.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster.
And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You made that interesting point earlier about the possibility of the Cornish-English boundary being one of the earliest national boundaries. When does Cornwall become subsumed into the wider English polity?
Yeah, again, that's a very complicated question and doesn't really have a clear answer. We're dealing with the shady, hazy, murky, contradictory, fragmentary Anglo-Saxon chronicles for our sources around this. And it's very hard to absolutely pin it down. But somewhere between the 7th and the 10th century, as Anglo-Saxon Wessex rises and pushes its way west, and then becomes the kind of the point around which a wider English state gathers and conglomerates. Somewhere in amongst that, Cornwall seems to have gone from being something that was sort of set against that as an independent entity to something that was in some way underneath English or Anglo-Saxon suzerainty, somehow acknowledging supremacy of these English kings. Without becoming English, it remained sort of British, a place of waylass, these foreigners or these non-English people. So it's hard to say exactly where and when it happened. We know that the border, or we're fairly sure that the border was fixed in the middle of the 10th century by Athelstan, who's arguably the first proper English king. Why? We're not entirely sure. Cornwall had almost certainly already been under some kind of wider English domination at that point. But for some reason, Athelstan formalized the Tamar as this border between Anglo-Saxons and Britons, proto-Cornish. So really that setting of the border is where Cornwall becomes fixed. And it sets it up to endure, even though it did end up being, for the most part, administered as an English county as, you know, England developed over the subsequent 1,000 years or so. It still retained that slight aura of difference, that slight aura of separateness. Unlike Cumbria, which started out in the same kind of condition, a place that was occupied by Britons, non-English, with their own chiefs or kings speaking a Brythonic language, that vanished, ceased to be distinct in the way that Cornwall was. And I think part of the reason for that is that geography and that very obvious border.
Has Cornwall and the Cornish always had an active independence movement then? You mentioned, you know, that perhaps some people today might query the presence of the boundary even as it stands. Has there always been people who've pushed back against English overlordship?
I suppose it depends what you mean by always. Again, all of these questions you have to hedge when you're answering them. There would certainly be a narrative amongst people who would identify as Cornish nationalists today that presents the entirety of Cornish history as one of resistance. There were certainly military engagements between Britons, proto-Cornish, and Anglo-Saxons back in that period between the 6th and the 10th century. We know there were. And there are people who will argue that that has continued right the way down through. It was always a story of resistance. Personally, I don't think that is actually true. I think that narrative is a very modern construct. I think in the 19th, the 18th, the 17th century, most Cornish people would have been less explicit about the idea of Cornwall being utterly distinct from England. I think there was a slow process of assimilation. But the really remarkable story is the fact that a kind of kernel of difference did endure through all of that. There were certainly periods where Cornwall produced rebellions. In the 15th and 16th century, it produced two very well-known ones, one in 1497 and one in the middle of the following century, which is the biggest and best-known one, the Prayer Book Rebellion, which is often presented as being a kind of ethno-nationalist revolt against the Reformation, against the intrusion of the English language into church services. That's a gross oversimplification. That was a factor for some people, but most of Cornwall was speaking English by that stage. And there were similar resistances to the Reformation all across England in the same period. So it's slightly wishful thinking to portray that as being some kind of Celtic ethno-nationalist revolt against English colonization. I think that does a disservice to the complexity and the ambiguities of Cornwall.
Well, happily for listeners to the podcast, if you want to get into the complexities of that, then we've got an episode which is all about the Prayer Rebellion with Professor Mark Stoyle. So you can listen to that to answer some of those simplifications and get more nuance. Is there a definitive moment where Cornwall is part of England, where an English king sort of specifically says Cornwall is part of my realm?
No, but then presumably when Athelstan fixed that border back in the middle of the 10th century, he regarded it as some kind of vassal of his. So I think we can assume that by that point, English kings, right from the very, very beginning, were regarding Cornwall as theirs, but they were not regarding its people as their people. I mean, quite explicitly, it was the land of Wales. They were Britons. And that idea of a distinction between English and Britons, that survives and continues and is still present after the Norman conquest. I mean, you still get talk of people in Cornwall and people in Wales being Britons, and then people everywhere else being English into the 12th and 13th century. So that distinction was still there. So I think right from the get-go, right from Athelstan, Cornwall was regarded by the English state as belonging to them, but somehow being extraordinary or peculiar, not quite part of the same framework as everything else.
Okay, let's move on from that. I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the sort of the main industries that have dominated Cornwall. We've talked about the fact that it's basically a maritime province. Fishing has clearly always been an important part of the place's economic activity. What can you tell us about that? How long has it sort of dominated the Cornish economic picture for?
Well, you know, Cornwall's a coastal place, so Cornwall has always looked to the sea, and fishing has been part of Cornwall's heritage as far back as people have been there. There have been excavations of Romano-British and Iron Age period settlements where the floors of the houses were just full of trampled fish bones. So fish was clearly a hugely important part of people's diet from the earliest stage. Obviously, it would be. The really interesting and distinctive aspect of Cornwall's fishing economy and fishing culture was the pilchard industry, which we tend to associate with the 18th and 19th century, but it goes back far, far earlier than that. There was a well-organized pilchard fishery on quite a large scale, certainly going on in the 16th century and probably well before that. I mean, those are the earliest records of it in the 15th, 16th century, but presumably went on much earlier than that. And this is a really distinctive, unusual, and distinctly Cornish communal way of fishing. So pilchard shoals, huge shoals of pilchards would come up along the coast of Cornwall in late summer and into the autumn. And they were harvested using seine nets, these huge nets, which were worked very close to shore. Spotters on the cliff tops would keep an eye out over the coast, and they would be able to see the pilchard shoals as they came ashore. You could see the shadowing on the water and see the flocks of seabirds on the top. And they would direct open boats out into the water, who would cast these huge nets around a shoal of pilchards, and they could net multiple millions of fish in a single net. They would then kind of drag it into the shallows, but the nets were too big and the shoals were too big to draw up into the boats. These were small open rowing boats, or to draw onto the shore. So they then had to take the fish out of the bigger net using sort of smaller nets, which were called a tuck net, which was a kind of miniature version of the same thing. And it could take them 3 days to empty a net once they got a shoal captured. And the fish were initially, in the early days, they were smoked, but then as it developed as a major export fishery, they were salted. They were preserved in salt and packed into barrels and exported to, particularly to the Mediterranean, in particular to Italy. It was peculiarly run on a very, very simple structure with open rowing boats. And that's one of the reasons why Cornwall's fishing industry to this day is not as well capitalized and is dominated by smaller boats than the big fishing ports of the East Coast. Because as an industrialized fishery, it was done close to shore with open rowing boats.
Would I be right in assuming that given the seafaring heritage of the place and the fact that Cornwall is so dominated by ocean, that Cornish ships and Cornish sailors formed a substantial part of the wider English and British maritime imperial story?
Cornwall was at the forefront of maritime British history. And again, that takes us back to the idea of the sea as the main communicating element. Cornwall was the main point of entry for international traffic into Britain for a very long time. If you were approaching from the west, if you're approaching from the Atlantic, if you're approaching from the Bay of Biscay, the first safe landfalls, the first major ports were in Cornwall, in particular the Fal Estuary, which is a huge natural harbour on the south coast of Cornwall, sheltered by the Lizard. And Falmouth developed as the preeminent international port for Britain. That was where the transatlantic mail packets made landfall. That was, prior to that, that was generally the first place people ran into when they were sailing from the Americas, from Africa, from Asia. Falmouth was where you came ashore. Falmouth was where you cleared customs. So Cornwall and Cornish sailors were, yeah, very much at the forefront of the age of sail. It was the shift to steam as the dominant power for maritime traffic that drew that away from Cornwall. Once you could just plough straight on up the English Channel to Bournemouth and Southampton, then Cornwall kind of fell by the wayside and Cornwall's ports went to being backwaters. But in the age of sail, Falmouth was the equivalent to Heathrow Airport and Dover.
Okay, what about mining? Tell us about the role of mining in the Cornish story. Obviously, it's a very important part of its economic story.
It is, and it's ancient, and it again takes us back to those sea networks and those links. I was saying a little bit earlier that from the Bronze Age onwards, Cornwall was linked into European trade networks through its metal, through the ores that are there in the bedrock of Cornwall. Cornwall's underpinned by granite. There's a huge granite intrusion that lies underneath the whole of the Cornish Peninsula. And it's very heavily mineralized. So it's full of tin ores and copper ores and various other things, gold and silver and lead and so on. And that was mined from the early stages, from the Bronze Age. It was initially gathered at the surface. People would kind of hack into visible seams in cliff faces, or they would work along valleys, sifting the alluvial matter to get the heavy ores out of it. And because the rock was just so hard, they couldn't really very effectively dig to any great depth underground. But there was a lot of stuff at the surface. So for thousands of years, that was the main mode of mining. In the medieval period, they gradually began to go a little bit deeper underground. But as soon as you go underground, you run into the problem of water. So the greatest restriction was the difficulty in pumping water out of mines as you sank them below ground. And that kept mining fairly close to the surface until the 18th century. As soon as steam technology arrived, that just allowed Cornish mining to go berserk, to create incredibly deep mines that went down on the vertical half a mile or so and might extend for hundreds upon hundreds of miles on the horizontal and on the diagonal, following loads of tin and copper principally. Copper in the first instance was the main focus, and then tin became dominant later on. In the major mining districts, which would be around Campbell and Redruth in the far west, around Pendeen and St Just, also around the edges of Bodmin Moor and around St Austell. It was a huge, huge industry. And it's really important to remember that Cornwall, though it's today seen as this very rural, almost timeless historical place, Cornwall was actually one of the first significantly industrialized places in Europe. But it was also one of the first deindustrialized places when the mining industry went into decline.
And I suppose in some ways, the mining industry has been replaced as the economic driver in Cornwall by the tourist industry. What can you tell us about when Cornwall became a destination for tourism?
Yeah, you'll quite often get this idea that tourism is a specifically modern thing in Cornwall, and often described very negatively as if it's a sort of blight, a disease that has come upon Cornwall. But tourism has been around in Cornwall for a long time. What we might think of as mass tourism probably could be said to begin once Cornwall was linked into the national rail networks in the 1850s. Once it was connected up to London via main line, then you had package tourists. By the 1860s, Thomas Cook was regularly bringing organised tours to Cornwall, and there was clearly a tourist industry going. The first sort of tented holiday camps were up and running by the late Victorian period. Big railway hotels were opening in that sort of period as well, in places like Padstow and St Ives. Falmouth and Penzance were already known as resorts. That was often for longer term stays. That was where you went to spend a winter, you know, where the climate was a bit milder, or maybe you retired if you had been in colonial service or whatever it was. But actually, you know, tourism of a kind had existed before that. People coming through Cornwall, as I mentioned earlier, coming in through the ports as they arrived from the Americas, from Asia and Africa. So there was a service industry amongst people passing through. There was a tourism of a kind there. And people did take excursions. It was quite a common thing to arrive in Falmouth from wherever it was you'd sailed from and spend a couple of days looking around. This is back into the 18th century. And you know, travellers and travel writers were coming quite regularly from the early 19th century to tour Cornwall, to look at its features, to examine its landscapes and examine its industries. And they would find accommodation available for them, and they would find people to guide them. So tourism has been around in some form for a good long while, and I think it stands as a traditional industry in Cornwall every bit as much as fishing or mining does.
You've mentioned a few times that there is a sense of separateness of Cornwall from England, and some Cornish people would see that quite strongly, others less so, I guess. But I wonder how much of Cornish identity today is kind of a recent invention or a reinvention of imagined identities from the past.
Are you asking me the awkward questions that are designed to get me into trouble, Dave? These are definitely things that people get upset about. And I think in a way that answers the question. You know, these days if you look at any article published online about Cornwall that mentions the word England and that mentions the word county within it, have a look at the reader comments below the line, and there'll be a flurry of angry responses saying it's not England and it's not a county. People are very insistent on calling it a duchy, which is a peculiar thing because that's really quite a recent thing, and it seems actually mainly to have emerged in the tourist literature of the early 20th century, this thing of calling Cornwall a duchy. So to answer that question, Cornish identity as it is now is very much a construction, a thing that has been put together, a thing that developed through the 20th century, really starting in the 1900s, but in particular the 1920s, when the language, the Cornish language, which had been moribund, certainly not spoken as a full language in itself, as a community language for over a century at that point, but it was then revived. Yeah, these cultural institutions were set up, old festivals were reimagined and restarted. And that process kind of carried on. And then in the 80s and 90s, you had a second wave of this. The Cornish flag became very prominent. More people started learning the language, more new festivals were set up. And I think it's really important to be open and honest about that, because that just because those things are inventions or relatively recent creations doesn't mean they're not authentic, because they rest on a very long history. going right back into prehistory of Cornish distinctiveness. But what we have to be careful about is not claiming that all people were secretly speaking the Cornish language with unbroken continuity all the way through, that, you know, the prayer book rebellion was all about the Cornish language, that these various festivals that were cooked up in the 1920s or in the 1980s have been continued in unbroken lineage since the depths of prehistory, because that's just not true. You know, things like the Cornish tartan, which is now used as a quite widespread and strong badge of Cornish identity, that has no historical heritage beyond the mid-20th century. It was literally invented as a thing at that point. The Cornish flag, the black and white cross of St. Piran, which is ubiquitous in Cornwall now, it wasn't even that common when I was a child in the 80s. I mean, it was definitely there. We knew what it was, but it wasn't absolutely everywhere. And although there are a couple of references to it in 19th century texts as a historical thing, if you just showed that flag to a 19th century Cornish person, they almost certainly wouldn't have known what it was. So the manifestations, the flags, the badges of modern Cornish identity, we have to be honest and open about their constructedness, but that doesn't mean they're not genuine. It's only when we try and pretend that they are ancient things going back into the time of King Arthur or whatever that it becomes problematic.
Ah, now, we haven't talked about King Arthur. That was one of the questions on my list which I've skipped past. I mean, we need to sort of wrap up a bit, but super quickly, where does this link between Arthuriana and Merlin and Cornwall stem from?
Oh, what have I done? I should have kept my mouth shut. I'm always very, very happy to skip over King Arthur. We could just rewind, and I'll not mention him. But look, you've asked about King Arthur now. King Arthur. Okay, so let's be clear in the outset. King Arthur did not exist. There was no British king by the name of Arthur, as far as we're aware. There's no trace of him in the Welsh king lists, in the Welsh chronologies, which is the major source for British kings of the post-Roman period, including the Cornish ones. Arthur isn't there. He didn't exist. We kind of assume that he was some sort of folk hero of the Britons, possibly or probably emerging at the time of the Anglo-Saxon settlement, where there would have been some kind of ethnic tension between Britons and Anglo-Saxons. So a sort of Robin Hood figure, possibly of resistance against the Anglo-Saxons. Inevitably, if he was this British folk hero of the Britons, the places where those stories would endure are the places that were still peopled mainly by Britons after the successful completion of the Anglo-Saxon settlement. So that's Wales and Cornwall. So yeah, there would have been traces of Arthurian folklore in Cornwall. But Arthur rapidly became this literary figure, beginning with Geoffrey of Monmouth in the 13th century, creating an entirely fabricated narrative of British history, and then picked up by various other literary figures right down to the 19th century, and creating all of this romance and all of this nonsense around the idea of King Arthur, which played into tourism. I mean, it created Tintagel as a tourist destination. But as for Arthur as an authentic part of Cornish history, no, there's much more interesting and much more authentic things going on than that. And I think a real notable indication of that is the places associated with King Arthur in Cornwall, the places named for King Arthur, King Arthur's Hall, King Arthur's Coit, King Arthur's Bed, King Arthur's Graves, those are all English language place names, which tells us that they are recent. They are not Cornish language place names. So that tells you that King Arthur's presence as part of the landscape and the history of Cornwall is relatively shallow, I think.
That was Tim Hannigan. The Granite Kingdom, A Cornish Journey is published by Head of Zeus. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Sam Leal Green.